From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show this week are Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor at National Journal. And here are the issues. A temporary ban on immigration from six Muslim-majority countries has gone into effect in the United States, but the Supreme Court ruled exceptions must be made for immigrants with family ties or connections with businesses or institutions in the U.S. In Washington, Senate Republicans failed to come up with the votes to pass a replacement for President Obama's health care plan. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has come under media criticism for allegedly being slow to adjust to his job and at odds with President Trump. And in Venezuela, a helicopter waving a sign about ousting tyrants from office dropped grenades in Caracas on the Supreme Court. That's a puzzling development, but we will get to it here. Let me start with the ban. I'll start with you, Tom. I was not at all surprised that the Supreme Court did this, but it is temporary, and it does indicate, you know, when the Supreme Court says we're going to allow this go into effect before we do our final ruling, it usually means that they think they're going to rule one way or the other, and in this case, to uphold the ban.
I suspect that's right, Fred. This is as somebody described this, this decision was a compromise that nobody, neither side had asked for.
Well, that's true.
The White House had said president's powers to protect national security are not only inherent and implied, but absolute in a situation where national security and public safety are at stake. And the opponents said, no, this is just religious discrimination, pure and simple. There's a middle ground, and I agree with you. I suspect that what will happen in October is that the court will uphold the president, the administration, on this. But by that time, of course, it will be moot. They're going to hear the case, and they're going to hear it again in October. But by then again, the extra time the White House needed for vetting will have lapsed. But I think the White House will insist on a decision because they want a precedent to be established, and I think it will be established in their favor.
Yeah. Indeed. Linda?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's clear in the Constitution that the executive branch has the power to determine who may and may not enter the country. And frankly, I was surprised by the lower court rulings and am a little relieved. Regardless of one thinks about the optics and the message that this sends around the world, I think it's reassuring that that principle has been upheld. Another fascinating aspect of the event this week with the temporary ruling was the determination of who can and cannot enter the country.
Very touchy.
It was very touchy. And they said that close relatives are still allowed to come in from those six countries, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen. So who are close relatives? Well, they've decided it's parents, and including in-laws, so your mother-in-law can come, siblings, step-siblings, half-siblings, but not included were grandparents, grandchildren, aunts, uncles, nieces, and nephews. So this has caused its own little mini-tempest. But certainly we're not having the kind of uproar that we did when the ban was originally announced.
Well, yeah, no, Linda, I think you made a very good distinction between whether you think the ban is a good idea or not, or whether the president has the authority to impose it or not. And the court has vindicated him with some restrictions.
On the larger issue, absolutely, Fred. On the other hand, the president and his lawyers had said, if we don't have this, there's a dire threat to the country in the intervening 6 months, or 5 months, I should say. So far, so good. There's not been a terrorist attack against the United States, much less one from any of someone coming from any of these six predominantly Muslim countries. So anyway, but I think this is the right decision. And I think, as I said earlier, I think the full court will rule in the administration's favor and whenever they announce the decision.
And the decision will be moot because what is this, a 90-day timetable? I mean that's what was planned here. And you know, the other thing that puzzled me is if the administration was really trying to cut back on Muslim immigrants, it would have expanded it well beyond these few countries, these six countries, and gone to countries like India and Indonesia, which have many, many more Muslims and Muslim immigrants. Anyway, this was a tempest in a teapot, so to speak. Let's go to the other tempest in a teapot. Well, one of many tempests in teapots in Washington, Tom. The Senate Republicans, after House Republicans had passed a bill to repeal and replace Obamacare, as we call it here, not disrespectfully, I think, but the health care plan that was imposed was voted by Democrats, and President Obama went into effect, I believe, in 2013. Republicans want to repeal and replace it. They passed a bill in the House that does that. The Senate, it's not doing so well.
It is not going so well, and the problem for the Republicans is their margin in the Senate is very, very thin. If Vice President Pence votes, which he can only vote on legislation when there is a tie,
it's
a 50-50 tie, and that's happened once before this year, the Republicans could only lose two of the 52 Republicans they have because they're not going to get any Democratic votes. And so the margin is very thin. I mean, in the House you had many more Republicans, so you had a safety margin there. Mm-hmm. Here, it's very tough, and the problem is they're trying to, what's the old phrase, trying to fit a square peg into a round hole, because you're trying, the Republicans are trying.
It's been done before, though.
Right. Republicans they're trying to attract moderates, but every time a sweetener is offered to the moderate Republicans, more conservative Republicans get up in arms and they say, wait a minute, this is even worse than what the House did. This is Obamacare light still, and then they get upset. So it's really a tricky, delicate legislative maneuvering act. And the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell wanted to have a vote on the floor of the Senate before Congress recessed for the 4th of July recess. That's not going to happen. So the good news is they have a couple more weeks to try to twist arms and knock heads. But the bad news is all these members of Congress are going home to their districts. And every poll in recent days, I saw four that showed that the Republican version is monumentally unpopular by margins of 2-1 disapproving. So it's going to be hard for Republicans who want to vote for this bill to stare down constituents when there's a 2-1 margin against them. So we will see. It's been done. McConnell is well known as a masterful legislative tactician, but we will see whether this works. This may not be the issue that he wants to hoist his reputation on, because this is a very, very tricky one, and millions of people are starting to figure out that the Republican bill will cost millions more people to lose their coverage if it passes.
Or choose not to if the mandate that you have to buy insurance coverage is struck down, which Republicans want to do, then they would not choose to buy insurance, mainly young people. Anyway, Linda.
Right, and you know, one thing that didn't help earlier this week was the assessment of the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, which determined that 22 million people would be losing their insurance in 10 years. Now, as Fred says, some of this is due to the elimination of the mandate. So there are people who don't want to be forced to buy health insurance, and under the Republican plan, that would be the case. So this is not to say 22 million people would be unhappily uninsured, but you would have, I would say, the bulk of those people would be unhappily uninsured, particularly, I think it's about 11 million people who would lose Medicaid, which is the health insurance plan for low-income Americans. And I think, you know, having that come out earlier in the week made a difficult situation all the more difficult for Mitch McConnell, and really, I think, puts the Republican Party in a no-win situation, because if they pass this bill or a version of this bill, there will be a backlash. I mean, there's already a backlash before the thing even passes. You've had die-ins in front of senators' offices and, you know, people planning for protests at town halls. If they don't pass a bill, they look incompetent. This is what they've been promising for 7 years. They've got everything. They've got the White House. They've got both houses of Congress. And as Tom says, the margin in the Senate is very narrow. It's making it nearly impossible to pass this. Whether, you know, they've gone back to the drawing board, they're not giving up. They didn't give up after they couldn't bring it to a vote in the House. And he did get something passed. So I think the party, I think these members on the edges, whether it's the moderate or the conservative edge, have to look at themselves and say, what's really most important here, getting something I really love or can tolerate, or just showing party unity and showing that we know how to govern?
Very good. Now we can turn to the issue that I'm most interested in, and that is Rex Tillerson, the new Secretary of State, who is, you know, 1 week, Tom, you'll remember this, I think it was about a month, maybe 6 weeks into the Trump administration, and all of a sudden Tillerson seemed to be the most popular cabinet member with President Trump. Now we see these stories about him, particularly in the New York Times, but there have been others as well, saying, well, he hasn't fit in well, he hasn't gotten enough of his people lined up in the top echelons of the State Department. He disagrees with the president on certainly this squabble between some of the Saudi Arabia and some other countries in the Middle East and Qatar, and on and on. There seem to be these problems, which the New York Times and some other papers have really loved writing about. They've criticized him for not separating himself enough from the White House, and then for insufficiently tying himself to the White House. Anyway, Tom.
Well, it is a mess. I mean, it's ironic, Fred, because something has gone awry here, and I don't know what one of my sources years ago called the iron finger of blame. I'm not sure where the iron finger of blame should be pointing here, but it is true that Tillerson came highly recommended. Three of his most fervent supporters were people all three of us know very well. Mm-hmm. Former Secretary of State James Baker, who knows him well from their time in Houston. Former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates and former National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. All stalwart Republicans, and all three of them fervently supported Tillerson. And I think they probably carried the day for him. But it is, for whatever reason, it has not worked out. He now seems to be some critics call him the incredible shrinking man. Others just say he's the incredible, largely invisible man. He has said, I don't want to have a high profile. He frequently does not take reporters with him abroad. I think his real problem is the White House is an ideological White House, and there are people in the personnel process in this government with strong support in the White House, and they have been blocking Tillerson's choices for undersecretary and many assistant secretaries. And there was a celebrated story in the last few days in Politico that said he blew up in a White House briefing and castigated a 38-year-old so-called personnel expert. And Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, is reported to have said that was extremely unprofessional. And then it probably happened because there are stories that say President Trump really wants Jared Kushner to be the de facto Secretary of State. So it's a mess. It's not going well, but it's still early, but it's getting late.
Linda, just wait a sec. I'm going to take a break here. As I remind listeners, this is Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes, of the Weekly Standard. Joining me today are Tom DeFrank of National Journal, who you just heard, and Linda Feldman of the Christian Science Monitor, who you're about to hear from. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast, but podcasts are increasingly popular. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Linda, Rex Tillerson.
Rex Tillerson. I mean, it's just shocking just to step back and think about it. Here's a man, very accomplished, distinguished, knows the world at least through the lens of energy, and I think is learning quickly the issues that he has to deal with as Secretary of State, and he has a 36-year-old, you talked about the 38-year-old personnel guy. He's also got the 36-year-old neophyte on foreign policy in the person of Jared Kushner, President Trump's son-in-law, who is undercutting him at every turn, reportedly, and wonder if Tillerson can last the year. I mean, we had, this week was the perfect example. You had a speech with the situation with Qatar. The Qatari foreign minister, Al-Thani, has been in town, and he gave a speech where he was praising the efforts of Secretary of State Tillerson, who's trying to resolve the diplomatic crisis that threatens to unravel the Persian Gulf. But conspicuously absent in Al-Thani's remarks was any mention of Donald Trump. That was really brought in sharp relief the conflict that Tillerson is dealing with on this and other fronts.
Well, Linda, Tillerson is not the first Secretary of State, right, who came from civilian life and really didn't have experience. There have been others that some have done well, some haven't. Mm-hmm. I have a hard time figuring out who Tillerson's allies are or enemies are in the administration. I think somebody must have leaked that story from the White,
yes,
House that Tom brought up. Mm-hmm. And anytime there's a story, if you're in the cocoon of Washington and there's some story somewhere about some cabinet member blowing up, right, you're going to read it. And of course, I read it.
And of course, with the president's son-in-law quoted in the story as saying it was highly unprofessional behavior.
Yeah.
You kind of had a feeling where that was. I think there's another issue here.
Okay.
Fred, let me just do a very quick history lesson.
At
the end of Ronald Reagan's first term, there was a celebrated switch. Jim Baker, who was the White House chief of staff, and Donald Regan, who was the Secretary of Treasury, switched jobs. And I've known Baker a long time, as of you, and I asked him, why would you want to do this? And he said, the White House chief of staff's job is really important, but your staff, not chief. I want to be a chief. And here you have a situation, the analogy is not precise, but you have a guy like Tillerson, who is the chief executive officer of a multinational corporation, one of the most well-known around the globe, and he was used to making decisions, and if he wants to fire a guy, the guy is gone. He wants to bring somebody in. Mm-hmm. That man or woman is there within 3 days, and now he's being, in his view, or the view of his defenders, he's being pushed around by munchkins, alleged munchkins. And a guy who has been that powerful, all powerful in many ways, clearly having trouble making that work. Mm-hmm. Now, one way you can make it work if you don't have a lot of government experience, changing the subject slightly, is to surround yourself with people who do have that experience. And Tillerson's defenders are saying, that's what I'm trying to do, but the White House won't let me because they don't think my people are, the people I want in here, are ideologically pure enough. The only thing that you know for sure is that Tillerson's not happy. He was caught. Somebody asked him, a reporter asked him a question of the State Department after these stories broke, asking about this. He said, I'd like the process to go a little faster, which was his way of sending a message to the White House that he's not happy. But, we're 5 months in now, and the State Department is woefully understaffed at the highest levels, and you pay a price for diplomacy. There are several instances of foreign ambassadors from other countries, who now call the National Security Council because they can't get answers from anybody at the State Department, which is not the way it normally is working or supposed to work.
Well, I remember, of course, when I think Tillerson wanted to hire as his deputy Elliot Abrams, who'd worked at the high levels in several Republican administrations, and the White House blocked him because he'd been critical of President Trump during the campaign last year.
Right. It's interesting to me because there are people in the White House doing press for the president who were very critical of Trump during the campaign, had worked for other candidates.
Yep.
And somehow that didn't matter. That went away. And they are allowed to work for Trump and pretend they never said those nasty things about Trump. So there's a major double standard going on here. And I think that only adds to Tillerson's fury.
Yeah.
Another issue, of course, is that given the complications of working for the Trump administration, some people don't want to work there. It's not just a question of Tillerson not being able to get the people he wants. He's got prestigious jobs on offer, but some people are feeling that they could be bad for their career. If there are legal issues, you have to lawyer up. It could be personally expensive. I don't know if that would be the case at the State Department.
Well, then there's the one about anything you do may be vetoed by the president's son-in-law.
Exactly. If you're assessing your career, is this a good career move? You have to say, well, it could be a little risky. Not sure it's a good idea to go work for these people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Finally, Venezuela. What was going on there, Tom, with that helicopter? It looked like it was the beginning of a coup, but there was not a coup.
Right. It was very, very strange. You had this police helicopter hovering over the presidential palace, and there was a banner. And part of the message on the banner were the words 350, which is the section of the Venezuelan Constitution that says the people can rise up and throw out rulers if they're corrupt or something. Mm-hmm. And so it sounded like there was a...
It was pretty clear what they had in mind. Yeah.
Yeah, but now I think the pilot is in hiding somewhere, as well he probably should. What it underscores is what Western diplomats or hemispheric experts have known for a long time, that there is a lot of unrest in Argentina. President Maduro has not exactly presided over a renaissance after the death of Hugo Chavez in 2013. unemployment is high, the economy is a shambles despite their vast oil reserves in Venezuela, and so restless is an understatement.
Mm-hmm.
How it comes out, I don't know, but I don't think this was the start of a coup, or if it was, it never got off the ground.
Linda?
I gather it was a stolen police helicopter. We don't know if it went beyond this one man. So, you know, and there are some people suggesting it might have even been a false flag operation that gives Maduro more ability to kind of consolidate power. And Tom, you mentioned the Constitution. This week, Maduro called on the National Assembly to rewrite the Constitution in an effort to calm unrest, and some people think to postpone the election. So I ask myself, why should Americans care? Well, this is this kind of chaos in Venezuela could bleed over into neighboring countries and destabilize them. And, you know, Venezuela has the largest oil reserves in the world. And if that were to shut down for some reason, that would certainly affect the price of oil and gas prices in the U.S. and around the world. So this really is something that Americans need and the world needs to pay attention to.
Is this something that American policy can affect? I mean, can the president or Congress do something about the situation in Venezuela?
Well, the U.S. is considering stronger economic sanctions against the Maduro regime.
That's not likely to help.
You know, I mean, the situation is so bad over there. I mean, I have a young Venezuelan friend who's here in the United States who's doing everything she can to get, you know, supplies to her family, sending money, getting medicine over there. I mean, it's a terrible situation. And, you know, the U.S. wants to send humanitarian aid, but we know often that doesn't really reach the people it needs to reach.
Tom, do you want to add anything here?
I think the ability of the Trump administration or the U.S. government, I should say, to affect this situation is very slim. Even though Maduro has proved to be a failure as a leader, there's still a very strong anti-American sentiment in Venezuela, and I don't think unless the Organization of American States or others can weigh in, I don't think the U.S. can affect what's happening there very much.
You know, I know Maduro is a socialist, but I just can't imagine, Linda, why he would want to turn the country into a complete basket case.
I think in a case like this, it's his ideology almost becomes secondary. He's a dictator in the making, and it's all about consolidating power and it's all about himself. I mean, how can you, as a leader, see what's happening in your country, to see the shortages of food and medicine and just the deep suffering of the people and not feel compassion and not really try to do something about it and allow the world to help? I mean, there are no famines in the world that happen from natural causes. All famines are political. And something can be done about that, but it ultimately goes to the leadership and politics and not to, you know, other things.
I'd love to hear Rex Tillerson on this subject, to get back to that for a moment, I don't believe he said anything. I mean, it seems like American foreign policy it just ignores Venezuela.
Well, it ignores the South America for the most part.
Well, South America, Central America, well, not Central America, but South America anyway. Yeah, why is that?
Well,
it's longstanding.
Who was the politician who once referred to it famously as the U.S. government shows benign neglect to South America? I think that was about 25 years ago.
Yeah.
I think for the most case, it's still true, reluctantly.
That's all the time we have, but I want to say a couple things before we leave the air. And one is I've been doing this show, Issues in the News, since the 1980s, which is a long time. Shows how old I am. I've enjoyed it immensely. The Voice of America is a tremendous Voice of America. It does a tremendous job. It is so rewarding to hear back from missionaries and journalists overseas who listen to the show. That kind of feedback is great. I recommend this show. I know it will survive my departure, but I've really enjoyed it. I've particularly enjoyed working with Anya Zalewski, who is also retiring after 33 years at VOA. She will be deeply missed by VOA and by me, too. That's all the time we have. Thanks for listening.